Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Dr. Martin Luther King Day, the 19th of January. This hour of the program, the cover story of Mental Floss this month is Crazy Smart, Outrageous Stories About Legendary Minds, like this one. It's only a bit of the article. On November 5th, 1930, Sinclair Lewis became the first American to win the Nobel Prize in Literature. A Swedish reporter called him to interview him about the news, but the author, known for such literary staples as Babbitt and Elmer Gantry, felt sure that it was a prank call. So instead of answering the questions, he responded by launching into his best Swedish chef accent and taunting the reporter. The man on the other end of the phone finally hung up, and a few minutes later, Lewis received a second call, this time from an American who verified the news. When the stunned Lewis went to tell his wife he got a taste of his own medicine, "How nice for you," she replied sarcastically. "I have the Order of the Garter." Joining us this hour to talk about Crazy Smart, 11 Acts of Genius Ripped from the Tabloids, is Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie, a contributor for Mental Floss magazine. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Linda. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send us an email, you can do that. That address is talk@wpr.org. Hello, Linda. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi. How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
Good. So you found there are a lot of Nobel stories, but there are other stories too, like the one that I just said. Where the heck did you get this information about these people?
Well, I have to say that I actually co-authored this story with Maggie Kirst Baker, who's written a bunch for Mental Floss as well. So I didn't find all of them, but we did focus on a lot of the Nobel Prize winners because it just seems like they've got a lot going on. I found a number of stories just by looking at reports, contemporary reports at the time, you know, people who were interviewing them, things like that. But, I mean, it was just sort of amazing. If you Google Nobel Prize and weird stories, you can kind of find a lot.
Yeah, you sure can. Probably one of the most surprising is around, but the story about Marie Curie and the sex scandal is really something, isn't it?
Yes, it is. That was actually one of mine, and I was really, really surprised to learn that, actually. I'd always sort of thought of Marie Curie as this sort of, you know, inviolable sort of, you know, woman of science. Had no idea that she had such a sort of salacious side life going on, but, yeah, I was really, really surprised by that one. And what was really interesting, I think, about that story was how it was sort of blown up in the French press. In particular, at the time, there was a sort of very deep vein of anti-Semitism, and she was incorrectly portrayed as this sort of Jewish housewrecker. And reading the contemporary reports from both the U.S. papers and the French papers were just really kind of shocking.
Yeah. So it led to a duel, by golly.
It did. And no shots were fired, which I think is probably good, but it did lead to a duel and an angry mob outside her home, and she had to flee to Paris and to escape this terrible mob. It also led to Albert Einstein sort of pitching in a little bit and saying that he was really surprised that she was sort of, you know, that this whole thing was going on, because he didn't think that, you know, while she was very passionate about science and very smart, he just didn't think she was really pretty enough to have this situation go on.
So she was indeed having an affair with her husband's student?
Well, her husband had passed away. He won the Nobel Prize with her in 1903, but he was hit by a carriage in 1906 and died. So this was his student who happened to be married. And the way the whole story sort of got out was that the student's wife paid a man to follow them one night and uncovered this whole illicit affair.
So was she able to, did the press turn around on this and realize that they were being a little unfair to her and apologize for saying that she was Jewish and she wasn't? Not that you have to apologize for that. If she was, that's fine. But, you know, not saying the truth here.
Yeah, I mean, she wasn't actually Jewish, but they never really did, you know, they never really sort of made amends for it. And the whole thing did sort of blow over. She, in 1911, this is sort of the height of the whole scandal. This is when she actually won her second Nobel Prize. And she sort of just said, you know, the Nobel Prize committee said to her that maybe you don't want to come to the awards ceremony just to kind of, you know, lay low for a little while, and she was sort of the character that she was going to do it anyway, and, you know, eventually the whole kind of furor about it died down, and she kept working and continued sort of contributing to science in the amazing way that she did, and eventually they kind of forgot about it, but nobody ever really said to her, sorry, we dragged your name through the mud.
Well, we'll say that now, right? We're sorry that you went through this. I didn't know that her notebooks were too radioactive to be touched to this day,
Yeah, and it's kind of really, really scary, especially knowing, too, that her daughter, who was working on a lot of the same things, also died of radiation-related illnesses and also received a Nobel Prize. The Curie family had sort of the, you know, Nobel dynasty because not only did her daughter win a Nobel Prize, but her other daughter, who was also Marie Curie's biographer, her husband accepted an award, the Nobel Prize, on behalf of UNICEF a couple years later. So she was sort of surrounded by Nobel Prizes, the daughter
My,
was.
Isn't that something? Some of the most outrageous stories come from the DNA pioneer James Watson. Their discovery of the structure of DNA. This guy said some for being supposedly a genius, how can you be so off the mark?
Yeah, he was very surprising, but I think, you know, his story was one among several similar stories of these very, very smart people saying very, very dumb things. He in particular, I think, was quite shocking because of how recent he was and how much he's been a part of the scientific community and sort of very much out there. But as he's gotten older, he's just said some of the most ridiculous things, including that, what did he say about that? He said that you always feel bad when you interview fat people because you're not going to hire them.
Right.
And that's only, you know, that was sort of the tip of the iceberg. His later statements about race and in particular his feeling that Africa was doomed because he said, quote, that black people were just not as intelligent as white people. And just that he would say something like that was really, really horrible and shocking.
Mm-hmm.
And but the fact that he wasn't the only one who said things like that, who had won a Nobel Prize in the past, was surprising to me as a reporter and a researcher doing this story.
At least the backlash, as you write, against the 79-year-old scientist was swift. He goes to Long Island. He's chancellor of the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, and he apologized, as you say, unreservedly for his comments. Maybe someday they'll isolate the gene for asinine commentary. That's a great line. Maybe they should.
He was sort of a good example, I think, for me when I was writing the story of just how very smart people can really do some really dumb things. And, you know, there were a number of other examples that we didn't include in the story of people who had some sort of unfortunate and strange pasts, you know, including the guy the guy who won the physics prize in 1905. He won the prize for his research on cathode rays, but he later became the chief of Aryan physics under the Nazis.
Oh, my gosh.
And denounced Albert Einstein's theory of relativity as, quote, Jewish fraud.
Isn't that something? You wonder how a brilliant mind could say something like that or think something like that, don't you?
It is really shocking. And I think that, you know, there have been a couple other of the winners, and I should also preface this by saying that there are, I think, nearly 800 individual winners of the Nobel Prize, and by and large, they're all very nice, normal people who don't say things like this, but there have been a couple of sort of outstanding ones, and I think his name is Knut Hampson. He was somebody who I he was a Norwegian writer who won the Nobel Prize in Literature in the 1920s. And he was particularly interesting as well to me because the Norwegian people have had a sort of a difficult time in figuring out how to recognize him because he was also an ardent supporter of Hitler and the Third Reich. And you know, he has this amazing literary legacy and had been compared to Dostoevsky and was, you know, an incredible influence to people like Ernest Hemingway. But yet has this social and physical legacy of having been a Nazi supporter, especially in Norway, which had been occupied.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really interesting seeing kind of politics that have come out of this.
How many people, when it comes to the Nobel Prize, you highlight some stories where people have said, no, thank you. Can you tell those stories?
Yeah. There were four people who were told by their government to turn down the Nobel Prize, and two people who turned it down of their own accord. One of the people who turned it down of his own accord was Jean-Paul Sartre, who said that he didn't want to be classified by winning the Nobel Prize. It's his own decision. The interesting thing, though, about it is that once the decision is made by the Nobel Prize Committee, any of the prize committees, it's an absolute decision. So even refusing, I mean, you can say that you don't want it, but you still won it, and he's still considered to have won it. You can't retract a Nobel Prize. They can't take it back. You can't refuse it. You can refuse the money, but he's still considered to have won. And that's also sort of gets into the interesting politics of it, especially the people who were forced by their country to refuse the prize. The first of those people, and this sort of happened, you know, at the height of the World War and the run up to the World War II, and then through the Cold War. The first guy that it happened to was a guy named Karl von Ossietzky, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1935. For publishing reports that revealed that the Germans were building up military forces. He was actually convicted of libel and betraying military secrets by the German courts and was ultimately sent to an internment camp where he died in 1938. But he was unable to accept his prize in person, obviously, and because he was in jail. And at that point, Hitler forbade any German winners subsequent to that to accept the prize. And there were two more people who won during the 1940s. And another really interesting situation was Boris Pasternak, who won the Literature Prize in 1958 for Dr. Zhivago. At the time, that book was not published, hadn't been published in the Soviet Union, where he's from. And he was immediately forced by the Kremlin to decline the award. But what's really weird and interesting is that in recent years, it's come out that the CIA and British intelligence actually helped to engineer Pasternak's win. And the conjecture is that it was in an effort to humiliate the Soviets. But the agencies actually smuggled copies of the book out of Russia and had them published in Russian in order to meet the Nobel Committee's requirement that the work be published in the writer's native language.
That's quite a story. And the Russians had their own sort of peace prize, right? That story
they
is
did.
In this. How the world
they
ended
did,
with
indeed.
Two competing peace prizes.
And that was some of the work that Maggie did, but yeah, they sort of decided to go off on their own tangent, and Stalin created his own peace prize to honor folks in his country, and sort of as a response to the Nobel Prize and sort of the rest of the Western world. And in his foreign essay, from what I understand, that they were also. Stalin was actually also nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize as well, but the awards went to someone else, and I think that was what prompted their making their own prize.
This is an interesting part of the story, too. When Mikhail Gorbachev won the Nobel Prize in 1990, Soviet public opinion of the award was so poor that he had to delay his acceptance.
That's bad. Yeah.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guests. We're talking about crazy smart, outrageous stories about legendary minds. It's the cover story of Mental Floss magazine for this month. And it looks at a lot of Nobel Peace Prize winners. We'll talk more about them, including Alfred Nobel's story, which is in here. Also, an eccentric physicist who climbed trees in his three-piece suit. He wore the same three-piece suit all the time. But when you're climbing trees, you wonder why that is the case. And there are many other stories in here as well. An interesting story about Doris Lessing, who couldn't care less about the Nobel Prize. Our phone number is 800, and we don't have to just go with Nobel Prize winners. I'm sure that you know some outrageous stories about crazy smart people as well, which we would love to hear today. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Linda Rodriguez McRobbie, contributor for Mental Floss magazine, is our guest, and her article is Crazy Smart, 11 Acts of Genius Ripped from the Tabloids. Our number is 800-486-8655. And we go to John from Milwaukee for our first caller. Linda, hi, John.
Hi. One that's kind of interesting is a little bit related to Wisconsin's famous physicist who won two Nobel Prizes, and that's Bardeen. I forget his first name. But he was at Madison, and I read this in a book called Electric Universe. Bardeen was a pool hustler while he was at Madison, and he used to go out and earn money by playing pool in the taverns in Madison. And he won a Nobel Prize for being one of the three people, the physicists, involved with the invention of the transistor.
Mm.
And one of the other inventors that he was with was William Shockley. And William Shockley, they all split up after inventing the transistor. And William Shockley went out to California and started up his own independent physics research company, and he was kind of a difficult person to work with. And actually, in the book, they mentioned that at a party one time, Bardeen had introduced Shockley to his wife, and his wife said one of the first things Shockley had mentioned was how he was disappointed because his wife and his children would be less intelligent than he was, because he's kind of I think he joined that gene bank a couple years ago. But anyway,
right.
To go on in
mm-hmm.
Silicon Valley, because he was so famous, many physicists moved out there. It wasn't Silicon Valley at the time. It was just open fields. And he was so difficult to work with that all the people that went out to join him because of his fame as a physicist ended up quitting. But they liked the area so much that they stayed in the area, and that's why Silicon Valley got developed, because Shockley was such a jerk.
Oh, my gosh. And the guy's first name, Rhonda found, is John. John Bardeen was the guy's name.
Okay.
And Shockley's one of the people in this story.
Yes. William Shockley was, in addition to, I guess, being very difficult to work with, was also a white supremacist, and he was among the only three Nobel Prize winners to donate to the Nobel Prize sperm bank that a guy, an intrepid entrepreneur type, decided to set up. And I think that was about 30 years ago. But William Shockley is definitely one of the more interesting guys, and I didn't know that about his partner and co-winner. I think that's really interesting.
Thank you, John, very much for the call. And there are, I didn't realize there were 200 babies born from use of that sperm bank. Do you know anything about where they are, what they did? I guess your article says that many had higher than average IQs.
I think that there were a number of sort of protections put in place so that the kids weren't known. Because, I mean, if you can imagine, you know, you'll have press knocking down your door trying to find out how smart you really are.
Right.
I think that, you know, they're probably right to keep their identities a little bit under wraps.
Mm-hmm. Somebody ought to do an investigative reporting on that, though. I'm sure it could be done with the right person. And it also, as you say, now women it's common for women to choose, you know, the color eyes or the profession or the what a person's going to look at when you're going to the sperm bank, right? So this sort of began that, perhaps, getting people to think that they could have their choices?
I think so. But, you know, it is sort of odd and strange to kind of think about that kind of a, making that kind of a decision. But yeah, I do believe that that's sort of one of the things that really started that idea of how to choose your baby's characteristics, you know, through sperm bank donation.
Yeah. Thanks, John, for the call. We go to Hans from Sturgeon Bay next. Hi, Hans.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just curious if the authors had included Milton Friedman's remarks when he was questioned about his prize money after winning the Nobel Prize.
We didn't, but I'd be curious to learn what they were.
Okay. But at least what I've heard, I think it's common knowledge, is that he was asked what he was planning to do with the prize money, and he had responded, "Well, I've actually spent a lot of it already," which, you know, can sound a lot like wild hubris, but it really was kind of taking note of the life cycle model of consumption that he had worked on with other very important economists. That has to do with...
He was the 1966 winner or 1976 winner in economics, is that right?
I actually don't know the year, but I tell you, it was the 70s.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Hans. That's good. That's good. It still sounds to me like he thought he had it in the bag. There is a story about another economist who lost $4 billion, who sparked the worldwide financial meltdown, but still believes in his theory.
Yeah, he's sort of one of my favorites because in the interview that he had with Deborah Solomon from the New York Times, he sort of said, you know, she said to him, so it's fair to say that maybe this didn't really work. Like, you know, this idea that the banks could manage risk was a total illusion. And he sort of brushed off her question by saying, what you're saying is negative. Life is positive, too. Every side of a coin has another side. And I appreciate that sort of serious optimism coming from the guy who's been called the intellectual father of the credit default swap.
Really? Yeah. The story of Doris Lessing.
Mm-hmm.
She said she couldn't care less about getting a Nobel Prize in literature.
Yeah, I think she might be a bit cantankerous. She's, you know, probably best known for The Golden Notebook, but she has written a number of other books as well. And she was completely unfazed by the whole thing, just sort of said, you know, I'm probably going to die soon, so they got to give it to me now. And because Nobel Prizes are not ever awarded posthumously, she kind of has a point there. So it's good to get her in now.
Did she keep the money? Do you know?
I think she did, yeah. I think, you know, as much as she, you know, sort of professed to not really being that concerned about it, I don't think she would have passed that up.
And how much money is it now? Has it? I know you quote some figures of how much it was for somebody like Sinclair Lewis. How much is it now? Is it a million?
It's a lot. I think it might be about that. I think it also depends on, at least a year. I know it changes to some degree, and that's something that I actually didn't really keep too terribly good track of when I was writing this. I was sort of focusing on the interesting stories. But I'm not really sure how much it is now.
Yeah.
Milton. And it may also depend on which category it's in as well.
Oh.
Because, you know, for example, the Nobel Prize in Economics wasn't created until 1968, and it was actually an endowed prize sort of in honor of Alfred Nobel that was given by the Bank of Sweden. So they may even have, you know, a different sort of prize number.
And Milton Friedman was 1976. Rhonda's been looking these up, so now we know what that was. Nora is calling us next from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Nora.
Hi. Hello?
Yeah, go right ahead. Hi. Go right ahead,
okay.
Nora.
I actually, this is kind of funny because I go to MIT, which, you know, is where some of these people come from. Mm-hmm. My story is I was sitting in a biology lecture, and our professor starts telling us about the man who invented PCR, which is polymerase chain reaction. And what that does is that's like what you see on CSI, where they like get a piece of hair and then they, you know, duplicate the DNA like a million times or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is obviously an awesome invention, and you'd think the guy would be an awesome guy. Well, he was actually a kind of a crazy stalker.
Oh.
And his entire Nobel, like, prize, you know, his acceptance speech, he spent the entire time talking about this girl, you know, that he was madly in love with and stalking. And, you know, like, I just remember a phrase of, you know, I watched Jenny walk away and get into her car in the rain, and I will always remember that day, and that was the entire speech.
Oh, my God.
Well, I know exactly who you're talking about. His name is Carey Mullis, and he is a little bit on the crazy side. Among his more interesting facets is that he's an avowed user of LSD, or has been an avowed user of LSD, and he also believes in ghosts, but he doesn't believe in AIDS as most people think of it. He believes it's actually a collection of illnesses that are being thrown together by pharmaceutical companies in order to make more money out of it. He's a weird dude, I think.
He is a weird dude. And he's in the magazine, too, which you haven't seen. If you haven't seen it, Nora, you may want to look at it, because he's in there.
Oh, in what?
He's in the Mental Floss magazine.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, you'll enjoy seeing it. That's a great story. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your call. We have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. 800-486-8655 is the number. He also, just these stories go on and on about Mullis. He's taken a stance against global warming. He doesn't like the U.S. space program. He thinks that 90% of space research should go toward asteroid prevention, and the other 10% should be spent looking for aliens.
It's a plan, you know, it's a plan.
Right. It's a plan. I think we ought to look for aliens, don't you? That's okay.
Yeah, why not? And, you know, as the asteroid that passed by very recently and very closely to us shows, that maybe we should be worried about asteroids. I don't know.
Well, when these people do these outrageous things, do people still give them credit for their brilliance in a certain area, or do they lose all credibility when they come up with comments that are way off the wall?
I think it kind of depends on who it is and you know how what they've said and how they've said it. I mean, I think the really great example of Paul Dirac, that Maggie was actually the one who wrote this one, but he's a British physicist who wore his three-piece suit all the time, and I think, I mean, from the sounds of it, he sounds just a little bit maybe autistic. I don't know. When his wife asked him, what would you do if I left you, he paused and after a little while replied, well, I'd say goodbye, dear. So I think his sort of ability to understand and kind of human empathize wasn't so keen. But with someone like that, you know, I think that people really sort of make a lot of exceptions, or because he is so brilliant. And there are certainly other examples of that. But there are also examples where people have sort of lost credibility. I think Myron Scholes is probably a good example, not because of his, you know, betray behavior, but because he was sort of wrong about the black Scholes theory and, you know, the ability to manage risk. You know, they certainly make for really interesting and good stories, and it kind of makes you think, you know, doing a story like this, that the sort of upper echelons of academia and these very smart people, it's a bit like, you know, the land of the misfit toys from Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, where you know, sort of just things aren't quite working right.
Right, exactly. And the story of Alfred Nobel, a sad story, you say. What's what was sad about it?
Alfred Nobel, despite the fact that he had made a ton of money and was a very, very sort of brilliant guy, he wasn't really particularly happy. In part, you know, he had invented tons and tons of things. I mean, he invented things like artificial silk and, you know, aluminum boats. But the thing that he made his money off of, and the thing that most people remember him for now, aside from the prizes, is that he invented dynamite. this, I think, didn't, you know, he spent a ton of time managing his business. He wasn't the kind of guy who was really able to delegate very well, so he traveled to all of his factories all over Europe. He never married. He didn't have a ton of family left over. One of his younger brothers, in fact, had been killed in an explosion at one of his factories, so I think that probably kind of added to some of the issues around his invention. And so when he sort of got to the end of his life, I think he was feeling a little alone, a little bit like he also wanted to really do something good for the world. At the Nobel Museum in Stockholm that I actually got to visit to do this story.
Oh, you did? Oh.
I did. It was interesting. But there's an entire sort of little room dedicated to Alfred Nobel, and I was really surprised by some of the things that they included in it, which, I mean, definitely was an acknowledgement of the fact that he was a bit depressed. I mean, one of the things that he wrote to a brother at one point was that he wished, essentially, that he wished that he had never been born, and, you know, that he had nothing to show for himself or his life except that he kept his neck clean. I think that was what he said. And so I think he really was in a place where he wanted to do something good for mankind and the world. Interestingly, what he did in endowing these prizes, so it was initially the 5 prizes in physics, chemistry, medicine, literature, and peace. It actually caused a lot of uproar at the time that he did it. His nieces and nephews, of course, were not very pleased about the fact that they've just been disinherited from millions of dollars.
Right,
I mean,
right.
A lot of money. I think it was worth something like, now in today's money, I think the inheritance was worth like $186 million or something.
Wow.
And actually the people of Sweden were a little bit irritated with him because he wanted the prize and specifically dictated that the prize should be open to people from across the world. And back then I think people were, you know, well, certainly there were a little bit more nationalistic, and they weren't very keen on the idea of, you know, a Swedish prize being given to just anybody in the world.
What all is in the museum?
The museum is really interesting. It's not a terribly big museum, and it is a little bit thin on the sort of more salacious details like the Marie Curie sex scandal. But there are profiles of some of the, of actually of all of the winners, and there's a lot of sort of interactivity at the museum. There's a one theater area where they show interviews with a number of the winners, including some of my favorite winners, Linus Pauling and Richard Feynman, were, you know, and sort of getting to kind of see what they say and how they speak. And then there's also the room that's dedicated to Nobel. And they also do a rotating exhibit. They have a large room. And while I was there, they had dedicated a large exhibit to censorship and ways country deals with censorship and the sort of violence against journalism and journalists and things like that. One of the lead stories from that exhibit was about Karl von Ossietzky, the German publisher who was killed for publishing the fact that Germans were building up their military power. So it's a beautiful museum. It's in the older section of Stockholm, this place called Gamlestan, which has all sort of like cobblestone streets and 17th and 18th century buildings. And it's in this sort of massive building. It's just around the corner from the Royal Palace, the Royal Palace, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really nice museum.
Hmm. Let's go to Sharon from Marshfield next. Hi, Sharon.
Hi.
Hi.
In 1992, actually 91 through 92, so a whole year, I worked as an intern doing my master's in social work internship at the Masters and Johnson Institute. I worked with Dr. Masters, was my advisor and teacher. So I saw him every day for a year, every single day. And I was a part of his life and quite a big part of mine.
That's really cool.
It was very cool. We would talk with couples, and it was a counseling thing. We never saw anyone, but we did give a lot of instructions. And part of our discussion with couples was to discuss the human sexual response. So people understood what happens when you become excited and you go from start to finish. And in doing that, we discussed the biological changes in the body and how when you become stimulated, certain areas become aroused and inflamed, to use a non-sexual term. So he would say to women, we'd explain what happens, and then he'd say, have you ever been to the zoo and seen the monkey, I'm going to say witch, the monkey witches in heat with their cherry red bottoms? Well, that's what your wife is doing. And he'd say it over and over, and after, you know, a long time, I finally got the nerve to just tell him I was offended by that. And so one day we were having lunch in the lunchroom, and Dr. Masters, I don't like the way you say that. It's bothersome. It's really bothersome. And he said, well, what part bothers you? Is it the zoo part? And I said, no, you know what part. You know. He said, is it the monkey part? No, that's not. And then, you know, we finally, it's the witch part. It's the witch. You're telling these people that the wife is a witch. Oh, well, I don't see a problem with that, but if it really offends you, okay. And so for a while he'd say, have you ever been to the zoo and seen the female monkeys with their red bottoms? And then it kind of melted off, and he went back to the way it was. So several months later, he was very good to me, let me say that. And he invited my dad to come out and meet with him, because my dad was a psychiatrist. And we were out to dinner, and I was telling Dr. Masters that they had something in common because they both had a hobby of flying planes. And so I started to launch into a story about my dad when he'd go into the plane and he'd go up to the cockpit to meet the pilots. And Dr. Masters immediately said, no, you can't say cockpit. You have to say plane. If I can't say monkey witch, then you have to say front of the plane.
Thanks very much for the call. It must have been fascinating to work with somebody like that for so long, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thanks so much for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. We're talking this hour about crazy smart, outrageous stories about legendary minds. Our guest is Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie, contributor for Mental Floss magazine. And feel free to call us if you got some kind of story, and many of you have this morning. They're fun to hear. 800-486-8655. If you want to send an email, that is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Feel free to call us if you have your own stories of geniuses who are crazy smart. 800-486-8655. The man who was described, and he had so many things that we remember him for, libraries of information in his head, Linus Pauling.
Yes. Linus Pauling is, I think, one of my favorite people that I was able to profile from this, primarily because he just seemed, and obviously I've never met him, but he just seemed like a really nice, smart, good guy. You know, some of the stories that I'm not sure if I was able to actually put into this article, but he lived in California during World War II, and at sort of the height of xenophobia against Japanese Americans, he had hired a Japanese gardener, and his property was vandalized because of this. But you know, I think it just sort of more deeply entrenched his resolve to keep being the kind of liberal and open person that he was, and as well to agitate as much as he did against the nuclear bomb. And in that, he really did a lot to sort of parlay his academic clout into a platform to campaign against nuclear weapons, and mobilized a number of other scientists, a large number of other scientists, as well as other Nobel laureates, to also petition against nuclear weapons. And it worked. I think that was the really cool thing, was that it did work. His efforts did pay off. In the year that he won the Nobel Peace Prize, he also saw a ban on nuclear testing between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. So he's a really cool guy.
Yeah, and he was targeted by Senator Joe McCarthy.
He was, among a number of other academics at the time, but he did have to go before the House Un-American Activities Committee, and was also ultimately forced to resign from his teaching, some of his teaching duties at Caltech. But he still sort of, you know, continued on. And I think this, you know, this is obviously why he won the Nobel Peace Prize, when he did, which was the reaction to that was really interesting. And they have a newspaper clipping at the Nobel Museum in Stockholm that from Life magazine at the time, and it says something like a weird insult from Norway, because it's actually the Norwegian committee that gives the Nobel Peace Prize. And it was talking about his win. And now Linus Pauling had also won the Nobel Chemistry Prize in 1954, and he's the only person in history so far to win two unshared Nobel Prizes in two separate categories.
Isn't that something? When did he do the vitamin C work? Was that later in his life?
That was later in life, and that also sort of, I think people kind of use that as fuel to say he was getting a little bit old or a little bit crazy, because he did sort of say that vitamin C was, you know, kind of the cure for cancer that everyone's been looking for.
Right.
And he ultimately died himself of cancer, I think, in 1994.
This person isn't necessarily crazy, although the idea, I'm sure some people thought, well, this is a crazy idea. The whole idea of microfinancing and how that was born, I love that story.
Yeah, it's a very sort of, I mean, he won the Nobel Prize, I think, in 2006, but it's still a very, very current story. And I know that microfinancing is something that that people are either, you know, increasingly looking to, but also increasingly finding fault with, because the more something is out there and more people are using it, the more people are going to find problems with it. But Mohamed Yonis's story was really, really interesting. He was the head of the rural economics program at the University of Chittagong in India, and he started to launched a research project basically figuring out ways to lend the poor people in his community money. And the idea being that sort of small amounts of money would do better work than giving large amounts of money to a community. And he basically founded the whole field of microfinancing. And he started with just $27 and gave the money to a group of Bangladeshi basket weavers and stool makers in his community.
Isn't that something? $27 started the whole thing. That's something. Let's go to Mike from Whitefish Bay. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I have a rather sad story about a genius who really wasn't stupid, but was rather naive and guileless. His name was Alan Turing. He pretty much almost saved the world, possibly saved the world, by inventing the electronic binary computer to break the German Enigma code during the Second World War. And by doing so, he saved England for sure, and perhaps the whole world, because if Hitler would have conquered England, he might have gone on to successfully conquer the world. But anyway, Turing was sort of a homosexual, and in 1952, he was living with a guy named Arnie Murray in Manchester, and Murray left him and stole some of his things, so he alerted the police about the theft, and when they asked him what he was doing living with a guy, he said, "Well, you know, we're lovers." He just frankly admitted it. And in England at that time, there was severe penalties for sodomy, and he was convicted and given the option of either going to prison or being castrated.
Oh, my goodness.
And this is 1954. Can you imagine an enlightened place like England? And there was such an outcry from the scientific community in England because of what he had done to save England from the Germans during the war, that they gave him the option to have chemical castration, where you're injected with a bunch of estrogens, and he became so feminized and so depressed that he took cyanide in 1950.
Oh, my.
But if he would have admitted to that policeman that he was a homosexual, he would have done fine.
Hmm.
I understand that there's been an apology. I think this past year, the Prime Minister of England issued an apology on behalf of the government to Alan Turing and his family.
That's correct, yes.
Hmm. That'd be a good story for the magazine, wouldn't it?
He wasn't stupid. He was just ridiculously naive.
Right.
He was a very sort of, I mean, I've heard this story before, and it is still very shocking. He did so much and was really, I mean, the Turing machine was just mathematically beyond and technically beyond anything that anybody was doing at the time, and it's just shocking the way he was treated.
Yeah. Thank you very much for the call, Mike. I had not heard that story. Somebody called or sent an email wondering if you know anything about Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the Russian novelist, winner of the prize in 1970, and an anti-Stalinist who was arrested and deported from the Soviet Union. Is his story in the museum, or would it merit attention?
I didn't come across his story in particular, and the museum didn't highlight it. So I'm sorry I can't answer that.
That's okay. How about the bread guy? This is an interesting story because I read it and I wondered what is the truth here? Did he do good or did he not do good? The Iowa-born agronomist.
I'm sorry.
Norman Borlaug.
Norman Borlaug. His story and his situation now is actually really, really current given the sort of major debates over genetically modified food. Mm-hmm. I think. You know, he's one who would absolutely say that he did do good. He did figure out a way to make wheat stronger and to, you know, to make it hardier and to make it be able to be grown almost anywhere. But, you know, people are, especially environmental lobbyists, are saying that, you know, that it's not right and it's not appropriate. And I think it's very... He did all of this in, you know, the 1950s and ultimately won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970. But what I find really fascinating about his story is really how current it is now, how much of this debate over organic food and genetically modified food. And recently, a number of articles have come out that leading scientists are saying that proponents of the organic food movement really need to start embracing genetically modified food because otherwise there's no way that we're going to be able to feed our population. And I think he passed away very recently in 2009, I think just at the just this fall. And, you know, certainly would have had a lot to say about that.
What were his comments here? You've quoted that some of the environmental lobbyists of the Western nations are the salt of the earth, but many of them are elitists. They've never experienced the physical sensation of hunger. If they live just 1 month amid the misery of the developing world, as I have for 50 years, they'd be crying out for tractors and fertilizer and irrigation canals and be outraged that fashionable elitists back home were trying to deny them these things.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Well, what didn't make the magazine you want to tell us about?
There were a number of people who didn't make the magazine, and definitely people that I was really interested in. I think one of my favorite stories, I think I've already told a little bit, was the Norwegian writer. What I find so interesting about his situation, having been a Nazi supporter, was how subsequent generations were trying to figure out the best way to deal with his legacy. And I think that's sort of something to take away from a lot of these stories about people who've contributed so much to society, but at the same time might be a little crazy or just completely plain wrong in a couple, you know, notable circumstances. And a couple other stories that didn't make it in, including a woman who was a Swedish politician who ultimately won the Peace Prize in 1982. Her name was Alva Myrtle. She won the Peace Prize mostly for her work, I think, around weapons disarmament. But earlier in the 1930s, she and her husband were major political figures who were also proponents of eugenics and social design and controlling society as a way to for social well-being, and this actually led to a program of enforced sterilization in Sweden that lasted from about 1935 to 1975. And not everyone involved was forcibly sterilized, but a number of women were, including for reasons like epilepsy and, quote, non-Swedish backgrounds. So there's some really dark stories that were coming out of the Nobel Peace Prize, Nobel research
Linda,
that we did for this.
Thank you so much for the article and for being with us this hour. It's fascinating. Our guest this this hour, Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie, who is contributor for Mental Floss magazine. The article is a cover story, Crazy Smart, 11 Acts of Genius Ripped from the Tabloids. And if you want more information about Mental Floss, you can go to their website, which is mentalfloss.com. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks for your calls, everybody. We'll be with you again tomorrow from 9 to 11 to talk about interesting topics, as you will hear all day long here on the Ideas Network. So stay tuned. Great conversations ahead. Thanks for listening.